it kind of brings things full circle as to youth, to adulthood, and all the baggage that we carry, from how we try to rectify, how we try to fix things in our journeys as we go throughout our life. And it was just, it was one of those things that tugs on the heartstrings. It was just heart-wrenching, and I loved it at the same time.
That's Arnold Dahl Woolley from Bina talking about one of his favorite books, Khalid Hosseini's The Kite Runner. It's what we're reading. What we're reading is KAXE KBXE's show all about books. I'm your host, Tammy Bobrowski. Thanks for tuning in. On this edition of What We're Reading, we've got three great debut novels we'll be showcasing. Kylie Reed's story of a young black babysitter and her well-intentioned white employer, Such a Fun Age, is the name of her novel. We'll hear about a clever and lighthearted story about a truth-telling notebook that brings six strangers together. That's The Authenticity Project by English writer Claire Pooley. And Minnesota writer Kathleen West's debut novel is Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes, a story about a privileged high school, overworked teachers, and micromanaging parents. We'll also talk favorite books with community member Arnold Dahl Woolley, and Kate Winkler Dawson will tell us about the origins of forensic crime-solving techniques. Her new book is American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Stay tuned. Such a Fun Age is a debut novel from writer Kylie Reed. It's been called a story about race and privilege set around a young black babysitter, her well-intentioned white employer, and a surprising connection that threatens to undo them both. Amara Tucker is a part-time babysitter stuck in a bad apartment and a series of part-time jobs while her friends are settling into successful jobs with healthcare and nice apartments. Alex Chamberlain, Amara's employer, a self-made woman who has recently moved away from the stress and excitement of New York City, is now bored and unsatisfied with where she's ended up. While babysitting Alex's daughter late one night, Amara is faced with racially charged accusations, and this triggers events that will make the two women confront their own fears and flaws and find their inner strengths. The story has heart, and through the character of Amara, we get to learn about the modern social and racial issues from a black woman's point of view that will hopefully leave you thinking about how you interact with all kinds of people. I'm joined now by author of Such a Fun Age, Kylie Reed. Welcome, Kylie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Such a Fun Age flips back and forth between two women with very different life experiences in very different stages of their lives. Amara Tucker is an African-American young woman, a college grad working a couple part-time jobs, not really sure what direction her life is going. And Alex Chamberlain is a self-made, successful, driven woman who has moved away from New York after having kids and is now finding herself restless. What else can you tell us about these two very different women?
Yeah, Amara is definitely in that phase of postgraduate, okay, what do I do now, where she lives in an apartment that she doesn't love. She's watching her friends get promotions and wondering, okay, well, why isn't that happening to me? And, you know, she's eating the same crock pot meal about four nights a week, but she does love babysitting. And Alex is a powerful woman with a really wonderful support group of friends. She has a bit of a nervous energy and tends to overanalyze things. And I think the most important thing is she just moved to Philadelphia and she's lonely. And so I think that her loneliness and the effects of late capitalism have kind of, you know, negative effects on her and the way that she thinks about herself and her relationship to the people around her. And I think her loneliness gets the best of her sometimes.
I've read that you have had experience being a nanny or babysitter yourself for some affluent families in New York.
I have.
How did your experience inform Such a Fun Age?
I was definitely inspired just by the culture of caretaking and the clothes that you end up folding and the foods that end up on your shoes or the little items of a toddler that end up in your bag that you find later on. But I also definitely witnessed really complicated relationships between mothers and nannies and fathers and children. And I've always been really interested in emotional labor and domestic work. And so in many ways, it's an old story of, you know, a Black caretaker and a white mother and their child. But I wanted to explore what that looks like when a cell phone is involved and recording things as they are, and when notions of ownership are a bit complicated and delicate.
Let's talk about this recording that happens. Like countless victims of non-brutal discrimination that occur every day, Amara is the victim of a racial profiling while on the job, caring for Alex's 2-year-old. It's a pivotal scene that triggers life-altering events. What do you hope readers take away from that scene?
First and foremost, I hope that this is the scene that pulls them into the novel. I love a novel that starts with action because I think it's a good way to learn how characters act and react to the world around them. At the same time, I'm not really interested in reading anything that doesn't reflect the world that we live in today. And this is an incident that doesn't include the tragic violence that we've seen so often on the news recorded by cell phones, but it's still really traumatizing. And as a human and as a writer and reader, I'm so interested in seeing how huge socioeconomic issues boil down to tiny domestic moments. And I think that that's shown here in this first chapter.
There were some really interesting themes in Such a Fun Age when it comes to how white people view and interact with people of color. We just mentioned the scene in the grocery store with the video recording. So maybe not instances like that or the really extreme racism that we see in the headlines, but let's talk about it on a more subtle note. Your character, Kelly, who is white, is romantically interested in Amara, and he turns out to exclusively date African-American women. And Alex comes across as really desperate in her attempts to try to make Amara feel like one of the family. Can you talk about this different level of racial tension that's going on with Alex and Amara and Kelly and Amara?
Yeah, of course. So I write both Alex and Amara in deep point of view. So everything that you're hearing from their chapters are exactly what they believe. But that doesn't mean that they're accurate all the time, because I think that's how humans are. They see people a certain way. And so I really wanted to, especially with Kelly, have a character who really nails it sometimes. And he's funny and cute and tall and, you know, is really capable of really loving someone, but also can maybe be guilty of fetishizing someone. And Alex doesn't know that for sure. She isn't really, you know, she doesn't know his entire dating history, but that's what she believes. And that belief is a bit self-satisfying. But I do think that characters who have the ability to love someone and also an ability to use them are one, more interesting, but two, more accurate to life. And I think that that's a lot more accurate to how white supremacy can work, which is with a smile often. And I think that that's scarier than a character who's just flat out racist and using someone because Amara would know I should stay away from this person. The characters are really complicated in that way. And Alex is the same way. I think that she truly does have the best of intentions, but when you look at her intentions versus her impact, she can cause a lot of harm.
Another interesting aspect of your characters is this, I guess what I would call the Rashomon effect, that Japanese film where you get all the different truths from the different characters. I thought it was really interesting. You go into Kelly's and Alex's backstory a little bit, and you're actually the creator of the story, and I love how you kind of walk that line between who is remembering the events correctly, whose truths do we accept in this book. I just thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's my favorite thing to go into. Yeah, totally. In grad school, I really got obsessed with how memory works in novels, and especially with a plot-driven novel, how much you give your reader, especially when it comes to what actually happened versus how that character saw it happen. And I felt like the latter became much more important. I just wanted to show the reader exactly how these characters replay these moments and nothing else. Because I think in real life, that's all we have. And the way that people work is their memories are shaped by insecurities and jealousies and, you know, wanting to appear really progressive. There's so many things that shape the way that we see things. And so Alex and Kelly see things in very different ways. And I thought it was more important to leave it up to the reader to figure out how they felt about them.
Such a Fun Age is your debut novel, and it was immediately designated a Reese Witherspoon Book Club read, and it got picked up for a film adaptation. How does it feel to have your first novel receive this kind of attention?
It's fairly wild and surreal. To have two women, Rena and Reese, advocate on behalf of this book and storytelling in females is just fantastic, and I'm so thrilled to have that platform. On another level, you know, being on tour and hearing from women that, every tour I've been on or every place I've been to, there's always someone who says, I haven't read a book in 4 years, and this is the one that got me back. And so having that big platform to affect people in that way has been really wonderful. And also hearing from Black women that this is the first time that they've heard themselves in a novel is really touching and kind of reminds me of why I started doing this in the first place.
What's next for you?
Next is the film adaptation, which I'll be executive producing. And I love film, and so I'm so excited to see what this book can do on screen. And I've also started novel number 2, but I'm quite slow, so I'll take a few years for that one.
That's writer Kylie Reed talking about her new book, Such a Fun Age. And here's an excerpt from the book.
That night, when Mrs. Chamberlain called, Emira could only piece together the words, take Briar somewhere, and pay you double. In a crowded apartment and across from someone screaming, that's my song, Emira stood next to her girlfriends, Zara, Josepha, and Shawnee. It was a Saturday night in September, and there was a little over an hour left of Shawnee's 26th birthday. Emira turned the volume up on her phone and asked Mrs. Chamberlain to say it again. Is there any way you can take Briar to the grocery store for a bit? Mrs. Chamberlain said. I'm so sorry to call. I know it's late. It was almost astonishing that Amira's daily babysitting job, a place of pricey onesies, colorful stacking toys, baby wipes, and section dinner plates, could interrupt her current nighttime state. Loud music, bodycon dresses, lip liner, and red Solo cups. But here was Mrs. Chamberlain at 10:51 p.m., waiting for Amira to say yes. Under the veil of 2 strong mixed drinks, the intersection of these spaces almost seemed funny. But what wasn't funny was Amira's current bank balance, a total of $79.16. After a night of $20 entrees, birthday shots, and collective gifts for the birthday girl, Emira Tucker could really use the cash.
Audio excerpt courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio from the book Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed, read by Nicole Lewis. This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Author Khaled Hosseini's novels, The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns, are best-selling novels. They're known for being heartbreaking, yet beautiful stories, and they are 2 of community member Arnold Dahl Woolley's favorite books. Arnold is the owner of the Big Winnie store in Bina. He's also a public speaker and LGBTQ two-spirit advocate. He says The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns are heart-wrenching stories that make us reflect on our own childhood and what we have in common despite differences in race, class, and culture. Here's Arnold Dahl Woolley.
The books I'd like to talk about today are by Khaled Hosseini, and was The Kite Runner, and also A Thousand Splendid Suns. Yeah, The Kite Runner, there were so many things that happened in this book, and it's basically one man's journey. Well, actually, I would say two boys and then one man growing up. And the journey of his life with his friend, and when he reaches adulthood, it kind of like when we all retrospect back in time at what's happening, because sometimes our past is brought back to us in the future, and then we have to deal with certain emotions and certain journeys and life decisions as an adult, and then we kind of go back in time to revisit our childhood and revisit decisions that we've made over the years and how we've contemplated dealing with these issues and what we've done over time to handle decisions that we've made when we were young. And A Thousand Splendid Sons. This book to me was heart-wrenching. I mean, both of them are heart-wrenching. A Thousand Splendid Sons was this life journey of this girl over, and we have to think about too, it's like, you know, Afghanistan in yesteryear of what, and even today, you know, there probably really isn't a large difference, but what it is to be a girl growing up in Afghanistan and how people perceive them as and what they perceive themselves as too. So it's like looking through life's journey as this young girl growing up in these turbulent times and being viewed as property, and what her perception is of herself and other women and other, and how she perceives men and what her life's journey is behind the burqa. And it was just, it was heart-wrenching and beautiful to see what types of relationships that she would have throughout the years and to become the type of person that she was in growing up and to where she took her last breath. It was an amazing story. I do like to go into bookstores once in a while, and it's just, I don't know, it's fun. I think it's fun to walk into a bookstore, and it's kind of like almost like a meditation when you walk into a bookstore, because it's kind of quiet, you know, but you know, people are having conversations and whatnot. But it has a certain aroma when you walk into a bookstore. You can smell the book. And I think that's fantastic for, because, you know, everybody has their Kindles, you know, and I have my tablets, you know, my phone, you can do everything on, you know, online. But to me personally, this is my personal perspective on this, is when you actually hold the book in your hand and it makes a certain sound, you can hear like this hollow thud, you know, of like the paper and all that. And, you know, when you open it up, the sound that it makes, you know, when you turn a page, like, shh, and then in the smell that it has, it's very therapeutic. And so I like to go in bookstores once in a while, and sometimes they have coffee. I don't drink coffee, but I like to smell it. Once in a while, maybe a cup of decaf, you know. But but I just walked around the bookstore, and I had heard something about The Kite Runner before. It's like, oh, here's this book, you know. So I go over there, and it's like, and I kind of like flip through the, you know, look at the back, and then I'm trying to pronounce the author's name, you know, because it's a different language, and so it's a little difficult at times. But then I kind of just like flip through a few things. And I was like, oh, this kind of brought me in a little bit. And I thought, this looks like it might be interesting. And as you read like the first page, and it kind of like brings you in. It's not one of those books where they say, when we don't stick with it for a few chapters, you know, you'll start to be sucked into the book. It's like, no, it brought me in right away into this story of this boy. And once upon a time being a boy, I guess, you know, you kind of remember what it's like to be a child and what your thought patterns are and how you act. But also this is a child from a different country and a different time. And then what life would be like through his eyes. And because we always think about what would it be like if I grew up over here or over there. And these books really show that what it's like to grow up over here. And it was very interesting. A Thousand Splendid Sons, though, when that one, I got interested in that one just because The Kite Runner to me was so good, and it really brought me into the world, and I learned so much from it. And then A Thousand Splendid Sons is like, I have to read the next book. I have to.
You're listening to community member Arnold Dahl Woolley. This is What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. Two of Arnold's favorite books are Khalid Hosseini's The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons. Here, he talks about lessons he took away from reading these books.
And The Kite Runner, I learned about the culture and the things that were seen as beauty, the perception of what normalcy was over there. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, in introspective, I had to think, was like, well, my goodness, would I have the same perspective if I grew up over there? As the boys' journeys, lives went on, and how difficult and how scary it was over there, but also perceived as normalcy. The culture, the beliefs, how similar it was over here as well, and how different it was at the same time. And it was beautiful. And that's why I seen that things through like the architecture, that because it was described very, very vividly. So the architecture and the belief systems, the journeys of life from a boy to adulthood was just amazing to me. I do have a favorite line in the book, "For you a thousand times over." And this was said by, well, his name was Hassan. This was the boy that was a different ethnicity from Amir. And Hassan would have done anything for Amir. And it was, and he always used to say, "For you a thousand times over." And I wouldn't want to give the book away, but it shows up several times throughout the book, and that's one of my favorite lines. And it was a tearjerker because I did hear it towards the ending. I read it towards the ending, and I also watched the movie too. But it just seeing that, it was just like, oh my goodness! It kind of brings things full circle as to youth to adulthood, and all the baggage that we carry from how we try to rectify, how we try to fix things in our journeys as we go throughout our life. And it was one of those things that tugs on the heartstrings. It was just heart-wrenching, and I loved it at the same time.
Yeah,
I would recommend that everyone read these books. Everyone going through our own journeys of life, we get confused sometimes when we look at other people, and sometimes people are quick to judge. Why are these people like that? Why are they doing this? For anyone, wherever we go. And these books actually give a beautiful glimpse as what it's to be another person growing up in a different area, and what we would do in those types of situations. What would we do if we were raised over there? What would our decisions be? And how would we perceive ourselves even if we met ourselves in today's time? And so it was beautifully laid out for everyone to follow through. Just to see what the culture, the belief systems, the religion, the values, and how we treat each other and how we perceive other people. I think it was just laid out very well. And then the journeys of these people that are in these stories is amazing. And I think everybody could relate to it in some form or fashion. And if not, you'd have some sort of empathy reaching out to them. It's like walking in another person's shoes. And it was beautiful and scary and heartbreaking, all wrapped up into one. And the journey and what you learn along the way, it's very well worth it. I mean, these are very well-written books, and it brings you in, and you become a different person while reading them. And I think we could all learn something from that.
You're listening to What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Up next, Kate Winkler Dawson's American Sherlock: Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. You may not be familiar with the name, but Edward Oscar Heinrich, an investigator from California, was also known as one of America's first forensic scientists. He spearheaded the invention of many of the forensic tools police still use today: blood spatter analysis, ballistics, lie detector tests, and the use of fingerprints as courtroom evidence. His uncanny knack for finding clues and establishing evidence and deducing answers earned him the nickname The American Sherlock Holmes, which happens to be the title of Kate Winkler Dawson's new book. Kate is a documentary producer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, PBS NewsHour, and Nightline, and she teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Kate Winkler Dawson joins us now to tell us more about American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Tammy. Thanks for having me.
American Sherlock tells the story of Edward Oscar Heinrich, but can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. So he was really unusual in his time period because he was formally trained as a forensic scientist. And most people weren't. Most experts he worked in 1910 till he died in 1953. So this is more than 40 years he was in this industry. And then during this time period, almost anyone could call themselves an expert in forensics. And there was no real way to test it because there weren't formal classes and there wasn't a certification program. He actually had professional training, which is what made him a Sherlock Holmes character. So he grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and his father died really unexpectedly and tragically, and it left Oscar with responsibility of being the sole provider for his mother and his two sisters. And so he dropped out of high school, and he became eventually a pharmacist by the time he was 18, which seems incredible, but he was brilliant, and he learned about making drugs and watching people, so sort of deduction. And also an interesting note, he said this is where his love of handwriting analysis began, because he had to decipher the horrible handwriting of the doctors who were issuing the prescriptions. And so he talked his way into UC Berkeley, despite not having a high school diploma, and he got a degree in chemistry, and he learned about every type of science at UC Berkeley. Again, this is unusual in this time period for somebody to have that much education. So he became a sanitation engineer, he became a chemical engineer, he became a police chief, and all of these things happened before he became a forensic scientist, before he was hired as an expert witness. So he's considered the first professional expert witness, somebody who had real credentials, who could actually analyze the evidence. And what made him most unusual, I think, is because he knew so many disciplines in forensics, botany, entomology, how bugs arrive to a corpse, forensic geology, bloodstain pattern analysis, fingerprinting, all of these things. He knew them all, and he knew them very well, so he could walk into a crime scene, like maybe just a normal shooting death, and not just look at the ballistics, but he could look at the entire crime scene and come up with, 10 different tests that he could run to just give police a fuller picture of what actually happened.
We talk about forensics when we're talking about this. Was that an old term, or is that more of a new term? I mean, did he call himself a forensic scientist, during
He did not.
His work? Okay.
No, he did not. So an interesting, that was, I had thought about that actually last night. So he has sort of a sidekick, a Watson-type character named John Boynton Kaiser, who was a reference librarian in Tacoma. And John Boynton Kaiser and Oscar were trying to come up with what was his title. He was a college professor. He taught, criminology and criminalistics at UC Berkeley for decades, but he didn't want to be a professor. He didn't want to call, Boynton says, Kaiser says, you're not a chemist. You're more than a chemist. And so they settled on criminalist, which I'm not sure Heinrich was completely pleased with, because quite frankly, he didn't love being in the criminal world. He liked being a star. He loved being respected. He liked solving cases. But I think it just, he really disliked criminals, and he didn't like most police officers. So, I think criminalist is what he settled on. But no, nobody called themselves forensic scientists. And nobody even said the word forensic then.
Heinrich is not a majorly well-known historical figure, so how did you learn about him?
So my first book was called Death in the Air, and it was about a deadly air pollution disaster in London and a serial killer stuck in it. And so I had covered science before, and I love how science can be intermingled with murder. And so I decided I wanted my next book to be forensics. So I grew up in my dad's law school classes at the University of Texas. And so this was I felt like it was in my DNA. And so I just went and bought a book on an encyclopedia on criminals, which sounds like a silly book to buy, but it was amazing for me. And I, you know, started from the Pilgrims and worked my way through, and I started, you know, wading my way through all of the gangsters in the 1920s. I ran across this great case, which was the Siskiyou train robbery, and it was a botched train robbery in 1923 in Oregon. And Oscar worked on the case, and in the story it referred to him as America's Sherlock Holmes. And so anybody who's interested in mysteries or true crime or criminal justice is, of course, you know, your antenna is going to go up when you see that sort of phrase. So I was very excited to dig in and find out more about him. And I found out he has a massive collection at UC Berkeley. Thank goodness. It was incredible. It had all of his case files. It had his notes, his journals, his diaries, evidence that he shouldn't have kept. They found two or three pistols, and they had to that were loaded, and they had to come and remove the firing pins because it was dangerous. I mean, he had bomb parts. It was a treasure trove, is an understatement.
This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Here's the rest of our conversation on Kate Winkler Dawson's American Sherlock. In American Sherlock, you tell us about some of the important forensic innovations Oscar Heinrich was instrumental in bringing about, but you also hint at some really significant mistakes he made. Can you give us an example of one?
So, you know, another modern term that we've been using probably in the last couple of decades is called junk science. And so these are forensic science techniques that actually involve very little science. And it's called pattern matching. So things like fingerprints, you know, you take the fingerprint off of a glass of water that a suspect, you know, used, and then you compare that fingerprint perhaps to something, you know, a murder weapon that we know is a murder weapon, and you compare the two. So comparing things like fiber, like fingerprints, like shoe prints, like bite marks, all of these things are subjective. They're really, it comes down to the opinion of the expert who is looking at them. And Heinrich really believed that handwriting analysis was definitive. If you write something on a piece of paper, I can compare it to a, you know, different document, and I can tell you whether you're the one who signed it or not. Well, now we know it's just not true, that different things can affect our handwriting. Environments, medicine maybe we're even taking. I mean, there are so many variables. It could be your age. You know, do you have arthritis? And so it's unreliable. Same thing with fingerprinting. And if you think about, I really realized this when I was at the DMV a couple of months ago, and I was having my license renewed, my driver's license. And, you know, they have you do the fingerprint, and you put it on the glass, and it's, you know, for the state, it has to be a very high-quality fingerprint.
Right.
It took me four times to get the fingerprint right, my thumbprint. So think about that. If that is the high standard that the state of Texas is holding for the quality of a thumbprint, how are you going to get a similar quality thumbprint or fingerprint off of a glass of water? They're going to be smeared. It's not going to be pushed in enough. You're not going to be able to see the ridges well enough. And yet we're still using this type of evidence. And it's not been, you know, something that has been discredited in courts. And Heinrich developed fingerprint evidence. And as you'll read, one of his biggest cases was Fatty Arbuckle, who was a silent film star who went on trial for manslaughter for, you know, killing a woman accidentally during a party. And the evidence that Heinrich used was absolutely bad evidence. And yet the outcome of many trials that he was involved with were in his favor because he was so convincing. And that's dangerous as an expert who is convincing in court, who's using bad science. So he developed all of these amazing tools, ballistics and chemistry and toxicology, but he also developed some junk science that I don't think they didn't realize it back then. They thought a fingerprint is a fingerprint. They thought it was really easy using trigonometry to predict how tall a suspect is using blood spatter, and that it's just not the case. Now we know that. They didn't then.
true crime and crime solving and forensics, TV shows and books and movies, they're all very popular. Case in point, you love your book on criminals that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Why are we so fascinated with the subject?
Well, you know what's interesting? I don't know if a lot of folks know this, but women are the largest audience for true crime, which seems even more unusual. I'm a woman who writes about generally men killing women, and I love true crime. And you would think that that is counterintuitive, but it's just not. I think that women specifically, but larger audiences, are fascinated. It's like that voyeurism thing. I know a friend of mine likens it to sci-fi. It's kind of the same thing. Why do we love sci-fi? Because it takes you into a world that hopefully, fingers crossed, none of us will be involved with. It teaches you lessons. Like, you can watch something on television, like a Dateline NBC, or you can read a true crime book, and you can see what someone did wrong. Not to blame a victim, but, you know, what I would have not done in that situation. And it maybe in some weird way helps prepare you. My mom, who is 76, loves true crime. And I asked her one time, why do you like this so much? You know, I love it. I know why I love it. But why do you like it so much? She thinks it's going to prepare her. I don't know for what. If she thinks the serial killer is going to be in her closet and she's going to be able to figure out how to get away based on whatever she's watching on 48-hour mysteries. But I think that is that way of thinking. And I hate to admit it, but in my part, it's a little bit more of, you know, better them than me in some ways. Like, boy, I'm glad that didn't happen to me. I'm glad I didn't marry that person, or I would have never done that trip, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think it's complicated, but it is a genre that just continues to grow and grow and grow.
That's Kate Winkler Dawson. Her new book is American Sherlock: Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. And it is truly fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Kate.
Thank you, Tammy. I appreciate it.
Granny's always raving and ranting, and she's always puffing and panting, and she's always screaming and shouting, and she's always brewing up tea.
She had tried to return the book. As soon as she realised it had been left behind, she'd picked it up and rushed after its extraordinary owner. But he'd gone. He moved surprisingly swiftly for someone so old. Maybe he really didn't want to be found. It was a plain, pale green exercise book, like the one Monica had carried around with her at school, filled with details of homework assignments. Her friends had covered their books with graffiti of hearts, flowers, and the names of their latest crushes. But Monica was not a doodler. She had too much respect for good stationery. On the front cover were three words, beautifully etched in copperplate script: The Authenticity Project. In smaller writing in the bottom corner was the date, October 2018. Perhaps, thought Monica, there would be an address, or at least a name on the inside, so she could return it. Although it was physically unassuming, it had an air of significance about it. She turned over the front cover. There were only a few paragraphs on the first page. How well do you know the people who live near you? How well do they know you? Do you even know the names of your neighbours? Would you realise if they were in trouble or hadn't left their house for days? Everyone lies about their lives. What would happen if you shared the truth instead? The one thing that defines you, that makes everything else about you fall into place. Not on the internet, but with those real people around you. Perhaps nothing. Or maybe telling that story would change your life, or the life of someone you've not yet met. That's what I want to find out. There was more on the next page, and Monica was dying to read on. But it was one of the busiest times of the day in the cafe, and she knew it was crucial not to fall behind schedule. That way, madness lay. She tucked the book into the space alongside the till, with the spare menus and flyers from various suppliers. She'd read it later, when she could concentrate properly.
Granny's always raving. That's how the Authenticity Project starts. It's also the title of writer Claire Pooley's new book. Claire is an author from London. She got her start writing a popular blog on her struggles with motherhood and her alcohol addiction. The Authenticity Project is based on the seemingly simple premise of sharing the truth about our lives. Julian, an aging, lonely, eccentric artist, starts the Authenticity Project notebook, and before long, the notebook finds its way into the hands of five other strangers, who all, one by one, become part of a community this notebook has created. The Authenticity Project is cleverly crafted and perfect for anyone looking for an uplifting book with colorful characters. Here's our What We're Reading conversation with writer Claire Pooley. The Authenticity Project is the name of your book, but it's also an idea one of your characters has, Julian, who is an older gentleman, a lonely, eccentric artist. He writes in a notebook, "Everyone lies about their lives. What would happen if you shared the truth instead?" He includes his own story, admitting how lonely he's been since his wife died. He then leaves the notebook for others to find, read, and share their own truths. What a great idea. What was the inspiration behind this novel?
Well, actually, the inspiration was my own life, because 5 years ago, if you looked at my life from my Instagram feed or my Facebook feed, it all looked like it was pretty perfect. And the reality was very different, because at the time I was horribly addicted to alcohol, and it was causing huge problems in my life, so my mental health and my physical health and everything. But nobody knew that. You know, from the outside, it was all fine. And I didn't write the truth in a notebook, but what I did do was I wrote the truth in a blog. And that blog, writing that blog, really changed my life. And it changed the life of thousands and thousands of people all over the world who read it and realized that there was a way out of alcohol addiction, and there was life on the other side. And that really made me think, well, if sharing the authentic truth can create these, you know, these magical waves, then what might happen if other people did it? And that was the inspiration.
I really admired how you got into the heads and minds of all your characters. For example, we just mentioned Julian, who frequently reminisces on his late wife. And then there's Monica, who is organized and focused and independent almost to a fault. And Hazard, who is himself trying to overcome addiction, just to name a few characters. I thought you really brought these characters alive. How did you get into the heads of each of these very different types of people?
I didn't realize while I was writing it what I was doing. And it took my 16-year-old daughter to tell me what I'd done. So she read the book when I'd finished it, and she said, "Mummy, you do realize that all of these characters are, in a way, a bit of you." And actually, I think I got so used to writing as therapy that actually what I was doing was the same thing. I was exploring all, you know, my own flaws through these different characters. So Monica is a bit of a control freak, and I can be like that sometimes. And Hazard is an addict, and as I was. And there's a mummy Instagrammer who is struggling with being with a very, very small baby, and that really reflected some of the tough times that I had, you know, having small children. So, you know, although they are all fictional and they're all very different, they all share something with me.
I think it's hard to admit when we're lonely, or our deepest desires, or our biggest flaws. Yet each character in the Authenticity Project seems compelled to say so, or to reach out to others through this notebook. What do you think drives us to admit such intimate things?
I think we very rarely do. And, I guess what I would like to feel is that when people read the book, that it makes them think, next time somebody says, "How are you?" rather than going, "Fine," that you might actually tell them the truth and open up about some of the things that are really going on in your life. Because I think what we're all missing is that authenticity and that sense of community And that's really what comes through in the book, is the characters, through telling their truths, meet each other and create a sort of a very supportive community that changes all their lives.
A lot of the story takes place in Monica's cafe. Monica, of course, one of the characters in the Authenticity Project. You made this cafe feel like home. Would you describe it for us? And of course, tell us if there is a real Monica's Cafe.
Oh, you know what? I wish there were a real Monica's Cafe, because Monica's Cafe is my ideal cafe. And I think we all do this. You know, we sort of, you know, we imagine sort of our perfect place to hang out. And Monica's Cafe is very, it feels like being in somebody's house, in that all the you've got little armchairs and it's all a bit mismatching. And there's a bookcase with books in, and she encourages people to take a book away with them as long as they leave another one in its place. So it's like her little library. And so the whole cafe smells of coffee and books.
Have you heard any feedback yet on your book? I'm curious to know if people are starting their own authenticity projects, and do you think this would work in real life?
Yeah, I mean, what's lovely is I've had people say that reading the book made them reach out to a friend they hadn't seen for years, or it made them think more about what they put on their Instagram feeds. Or it made them, you know, when somebody says, how are you, it made them tell them the truth, and really ask their friends what's going on in their lives. So, you know, so it's been great hearing how people have, you know, it's a very lighthearted book, and it's a book that sort of is, you know, just leaves you feeling uplifted, but hopefully also makes you think a bit more about what's going on in your life and the life of the people around you.
That was author Claire Pooley talking about her new book, The Authenticity Project. Audio excerpt courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio from the book The Authenticity Project by Claire Pooley, read by Anna Cordell. This is What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Julia Abbott is a helicopter parent who has a tendency to overdo things. An altercation on school grounds at Liston Heights High involving Julia and a student is recorded and goes viral. Meanwhile, Isabel Johnson, an English teacher at Liston Heights, receives a threatening voicemail accusing her of teaching a blatant liberal agenda. These two incidents unite parent and teacher as a secret Facebook gossip group stirs up even more trouble for this school and small privileged suburb of Minneapolis. Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes is an honest and engaging story of people at their best and worst. It's both humorous and heartfelt. Author Kathleen West joins me now to tell us more about her new book. Kathleen, I really enjoyed the story. It seemed to me that you may have been carrying it around with you for several years while you were busy teaching. So how did the book finally come about?
Yes, that's a great question. You know, actually, I resisted writing a book that was so close to my life. I had had an idea of becoming a novelist for a long time, but then I got caught up in, you know, the normal adult things like working and raising my children, and I hadn't really taken the time to develop a writing habit or put pen to paper. And when I first started writing a novel, I actually started on a totally different project. It was a multi-generational family saga that was really never meant to be. And when the seed of an idea came to me for Minor Dramas, actually when my own son auditioned for a middle school musical, and I was really anxious to know what part he got in the play, just like my main character, Julia Abbott, is about her own son, then the words just started flowing really much more quickly, and the book just kind of came out of me, which, you know, looking back on it, seems obvious that this was the story that I was meant to tell. So you asked whether I was carrying it around for years. I guess I was, but I wasn't really conscious of that.
The characters in your book, like you just mentioned, Julia being very eager about her son's chances in the play, all the characters seemed very real. For example, the teachers at Liston Heights, and particularly Isabel's colleagues. What's the percentage of fiction to real life in these characters?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I definitely used my 20 years of experience to put these characters together, but I would say that they're kind of an amalgamation of all the people that I have worked with and known in my time, taking the most extreme traits from various colleagues over the years and putting them together. I think there's the principal stands out to me as a character that was especially fun to write. I've written a kind of inept principal, well-meaning but not super great at execution, and I then felt sort of like, oh gosh, I hope none of my bosses think that this character is based on them. I think there's a natural conflict between teachers and administration, and I kind of exploited that for this character. I definitely drew on like everyday experiences of a teacher, so the experience of chaperoning a dance and screening kids to make sure that they're all set to go to come inside, the experience of being at a faculty meeting, all of those things are my real life feelings and emotions about kind of the more absurd parts of being a teacher, but none of the characters are exact replicas of people that I've known.
That won't stop people from seeing themselves in those characters though, right?
No, I don't think that. It definitely won't. In fact, my husband asked me about one of the characters. He's like, well, how does your friend Chad feel about being gay in the novel? Chad is straight and married to a woman. And I said, oh, that's not Chad. But he saw Chad in that character. And a couple of other people have called me and said, oh, I recognize so-and-so. And yeah, I think it's natural for people who have known me to see themselves in the work. But I was really conscious of trying to make everybody look good in the end and to really make sure that I was showing everybody's best intentions. The truth is, in my career in teaching, I found that 99% of people who enter the profession are doing it because they have these really idealistic and optimistic views about kids and the future of our society. And I hope that comes through even in some of the more ridiculous situations.
Now, social media plays a really important role in minor dramas and other catastrophes. What has been your experience with social media in your own teaching career, and I guess how did you decide to work that in?
Yes, social media is inescapable, I think, in modern American life and in American schools. And overall, I've really enjoyed the rise of social media in my career. I've always been somebody who's an early adopter of technologies, and I had a Twitter account in 2008, which is, I think, the year that Twitter started, and I've always used it in my teaching, too. I found it a great way to amplify student work and to bring in voices in new ways. So I've been a big social media proponent. I think the dangers of social media that we all know about are that using these tools requires some thoughtfulness and reason, and those things can fail us in moments of stress, which is what happens to the characters in this book. You know, like when you're very angry and your phone is in your hand, bad things can happen. So I really tried to explore that. And I think everybody knows, but sometimes we need a reminder about how powerful our little handheld computers are and how powerful our voices can be and how our words can have lifelong consequences and last forever in the current media landscape. And as a society, I think we'll probably have to evolve because it's so common to make mistakes. So perhaps we'll become more forgiving. But until then, I think adults especially and the kids in their lives have to use extreme caution.
You're listening to Minnesota writer Kathleen West on KAXE KBXE. Her debut novel is the story of a modern high school, overworked teachers, micromanaging parents, social media, and the students caught in between. It's called Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes. Here's the rest of our conversation with Kathleen West. You've mentioned how you were a teacher for 20 years, and I imagine that as a teacher, you've seen just about every behavior in parents. But
yes.
But you're also a parent. So how do these two
yes.
things inform how you interact with your children's teachers?
Yes, I think all parents have the same inclination that Julia Abbott, my helicopter mom in my book, have. Like I desperately want what's best for my own children. When they feel pain, I feel pain. And I definitely have the inclination to shield them from major and minor disappointments in their lives, just like Julia Abbott does and just like the parents that I've worked with do. So I do have to coach myself as a mom using what I know about child development and psychology and everything I've learned in my teaching career about how important failure is. As a teacher, I really believe in providing safe opportunities to fail for kids, like, what better time in your life to completely bomb at something than middle school or high school, when the consequences feel big to you, but they're actually pretty small. Like failing a history test in sixth grade, for instance, is not really going to have a long-term impact on your life. So as a parent, I try to coach myself about that, you know, reminding myself that failure is important, rejection is important, friendship changes are normal and important. And as many times as possible, I like to let my children process those things in their lives, you know, on their own and advocate for themselves. So I tend to be pretty hands-off in terms of contacting my own kids' teachers. But I had the advantage of working in the same school where my kids went to school for 8 years. So I had really close relationships with their teachers and a level of trust with them that a lot of parents aren't lucky enough to have. So I do understand when parents feel like they need more information.
One thing that I think our listeners would like to know is, what about your story is specifically Minnesotan?
Oh, yes. You know, I am a lifelong Minnesotan, sort of by accident. I always envisioned kind of being a cosmopolitan person and moving from city to city, but just circumstance kept me in Minnesota forever. I grew up in Mendota Heights, Minnesota, which is just south of St. Paul, like a first-ring suburb there. And then I went to McAllister College in St. Paul. And then right after college, I met my husband, who is a rabid Minnesotan Vikings and Gophers fan and believes that Minnesota is the best place on earth. So we are never leaving. I agree with him that it's a great place to be. And so when I was writing this story, there's really no other place that I would write up about besides Minnesota. I think that the characters have kind of a Midwestern sensibility in terms of how they interact with each other. There's kind of that veneer of Minnesota nice where underneath there can be a little bit of passive aggression or something, because I think Minnesotans tend not to be so comfortable expressing their feelings directly. That's definitely in there. It takes place in a Minnesota February, and I think a Minnesota February, we all know, can be really tough in terms of the steely gray sky and you know, our vitamin D stores are getting low, and perhaps our emotional reserves are low from that lack of sunlight and lack of warmth. That plays a role in the story as well. And, I mean, I think Minnesota residents might recognize Liston Heights as a stand-in for a suburb like Edina or Wayzata
right.
or Minnetonka, and have fun making parallels there as well.
What do you want readers to take away from minor dramas and other catastrophes?
Well, first of all, I hope that readers really enjoy the story. It's gratifying for me when somebody tells me that they stayed up later, they couldn't stop turning pages. So I really hope that the story entertains them and makes them laugh, and hopefully makes them laugh at themselves a little bit, too. I think that, you know, as a mom of teenagers myself, if we can't laugh at our own impulses, it's just a long 10 years to get through in our lives. On a deeper level, I hope that people think about women and their careers and their motherhood and their desire for admiration and their ambition. I think that plays out a lot in the book. And just also the way that we treat one another, the value of direct communication and empathy.
Kathleen West is a veteran middle and high school teacher. She lives in Minneapolis with her hilarious husband, two sporty sons, and a very bad golden doodle. Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes is her debut novel. Thanks for tuning in to what we're reading on KAXE KBXE. Are you stuck in a reading rut? Or have you just read a fabulous new or old book? Share your thoughts on our What We're Reading page on Facebook, email us at comments@kaxe.org, or you can call our talkback line at 218-999-9876. You can find past reviews and interviews at kaxe.org. Just search What We're Reading. Thanks to Arnold Dahl Woolley for talking favorite books. We heard music on today's show from Lanterna, the Cinematic Orchestra, Valerie June, and the Kinks. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota, and by you, our members. Thanks so much for supporting our programming.